Good morning, everybody. Today is Friday. Yay! It's Friday, March 11th, 2016. And this is Before the First Cup with Jules here on UCY.TV. Happy Friday, everybody. It is 35 degrees and very cloudy here in upstate New York, but at least it's not snowing. It is also, for those of you who remember, the five-year anniversary of the tsunami and triple meltdown happening in Fukushima, Japan. I have Libby Hileve's five-year anniversary special that is set to air after Lonnie's show today. So make sure you stick around for that one. That should be a good one. And they're still melting down. So look it up, Fukushima. All right, guys. Well, where do we leave off yesterday? We titled the show something very simple after it took me 3.5 hours of editing, still having technical issues after the show and technical issues all through the show. I titled it Social Robots Everywhere. I never even got to the notes because by the time I finished working on my show, it was already 4 p.m. and I could not put any more time into it. I have no idea what we talked about. I remember we talked about Nadine, the personal intelligent conversing robot android creature that's going to take care of you. We also talked about those R2-D2 hospital bots. They're already rolling them out. I believe they had said they had them in 104 different hospitals. And don't worry about it because they're not replacing jobs. And very interestingly enough, 3 minutes before we went to air again today, guess what happened to my browser? Yes, all my tabs started spinning and everything went into flash crash. I'm really beginning to think it's intentional. I'm starting to take it personally. But just before that happened, I was smart enough to copy and paste the majority of the links of what we were going to talk about today into Skype. And Skype didn't lock up on me today like it did yesterday, blocking me from even copying those links. So what we're going to try to do is work on it from there if I can get these loaded. So, I don't know. At this point, I don't even know what to say. I won't get mad today, though, because it's not good for my blood pressure or my health. All right, so we were talking about personalized robots. I don't know, androids, ones that can converse, AI, same crap I talk about every single day. It's getting kind of boring, but you know what? It's what I do. It's what I follow, and I can't do a show on something that I don't care about, though right now I am kind of busy. I could be doing other things, like my mom is still here, but I'm here doing a show. Oh, shoot. All right, I guess we'll start with this one. And these probably will make no sense, rhyme or reason, because everything is cluster F here today. As usual, you can now sequence your entire genome for under $1,000. We had talked about price point and technology. And one of the big things that happens is once a technology has reached a certain low-cost point, the point of where people find it economical or at least a good deal to go buy, it's all balls out. And whoever that company is makes a bazillion dollars that Christmas. Well, according to ScienceAlert.com, the future just got affordable $1,000 for your entire genome, and it was something that had cost hundreds of thousands of dollars before. It wasn't that long ago that the first human genome was sequenced, a massive globally orchestrated scientific undertaking that took years and some $3 billion to achieve. And just so you know, this is now the same sort of global effort that is going into the Brain Project. And that's why we talk about the Brain Project a lot. We talk about the brain discoveries and some of this mad science that they're doing, because don't think that that isn't going to affect us in every single facet of our lives in the future, because it absolutely will, as they crack every single secret of the brain and how we think and how we act and come up with behavioral analytics and tie it all to their artificial intelligence. You know, the window is closing for having freedom. The window is closing for being able to do anything without someone knowing what you're going to do next, or being able to determine what you will be like in the future. You know, they're already doing behavioral analytics, and they are surveilling even children. I saw recently Claire Burnish, I believe, from Antimedia, had a story out the other day. And I had read about this a while ago, I think for the CIA, but now it's the FBI, getting high school students to be watching for suspicious behaviors and reporting friends and students for suspicious behavior. I mean, right now it's the kids. Tomorrow it's going to be their 10,000 gigapixel camera with 230-point facial recognition and behavioral analytics algorithms, right? So they'll be able to determine now that, oh, look, there's sweat running down their neck and they're itching their arm while looking at their watch. And, by the way, they're leaving early because their parent is picking them up to go pick up their aunt from Pakistan. They must be terrorists. You know, you'll at least get a friendly visit for someone to question you as to what your motives are, where you're going to be. Just reminds me a lot of, like, I don't know. I don't even know if I've seen a movie that has been as scary as the one that I see forming. Anyway, let's just read this. So it was $3 billion to achieve, and it took a global, massively orchestrated scientific effort to come up with this genome and get them all sequenced. Since then, rapid advancements in genetic technology and techniques have seen the cost and time required for genome sequencing drop dramatically, leading to this week's remarkable announcement, the whole first genome sequencing service for customers that costs less than $1,000. And of course, they could do this on volume because there's enough stupid people that are sending in their DNA to have it sequenced under, you know, finding out who your ancestors are or finding out what BRCA gene you might have. We talked about this months and months ago and looked at that 23andMe, the CEO, who is the wife of Google co-founder Sergey Brin. And they have tied this to all kinds of different future things, like being able now to come up with drugs. Remember, they had launched some sort of drug discovery company that was going to be doing precision medicine based upon DNA sequencing. There's just going to be so much money for people to make. And that Veritas, that's who they were. Veritas was the back end to that 23andMe. And they're doing it on volume. Remember, they were almost taking it at a loss to be able to do these sequences. But then they were given permission to be able to write mobile apps and put them in the iStore and whatever, in the Windows Store and the Android Store. So they have access to all of this public DNA information. Remember, you check that little box when you have your DNA test done, and your information can be used for research. Back to the story. It's just $9.99. My genome from U.S.-based genetics startup Veritas Genetics is being built by its makers is the first practical and affordable way for people to access unparalleled personal data on their individual genetic code. The company claims its personalized service offers an accessible way to keep tabs on your current health and keep you abreast of any potential future issues and even know what inherited genes you might pass on to your children. You know, and they're playing on many different things here that we've talked about. They're playing on, you know, this future of being healthy and this future of putting everything online in the cloud, giving it all up to the machine. You know, they don't, I'm sure that out there probably isn't a big document that talks about what happens when their database is hacked or when somebody gets their hands on your gene sequencing, what they can create. You know, we talked about this way, way back, the woman in New York City. I don't know if she was a geneticist or not, but she definitely had a DIY kit that she was messing around with, and she was picking up chewing gum chunks and cigarette butts off the ground in New York City and creating representations, masks. Maybe she was even doing busts, but I remember it was an art presentation She was recreating the faces of the people who had dropped the gum and dropped the cigarette butts based on the DNA that she was able to get from the gum and the cigarette butts. She could actually make a representation of the face of the person. What do you think these mad scientists are going to be able to do when every single one of us, not just individual genomes, but collectively, once they have a large representation of the general public, which they already do. I think we heard back probably 6 months back that 23andMe was at close to 800,000 and they were pushing for 1 million sequenced genomes that had given permission to use them for research. And what they're doing is comparing and contrasting from different alleles to what one person has versus another. And they're, of course, they're saying that it's helping assist them in discovering all kinds of new treatments for disease. And that's the one thing that this 23andMe was opening a new pharmaceutical division of their ancestry division to be able to create remedies in conjunction with big pharma based upon individualized genetic information. For your cash down, My Genome gives you a digital report on your whole genome and an app to interact with your data. See, there's the apps. I'm telling you, if you want to make $1 million, start building mobile apps that'll work against this genome database that's going to be out there. And, you know, you don't need to know whose information it is. It's probably all done via some sort of like client ID number. But I was like, shit, if you could sell that for $5 a pop, find out whether or not you got the cancer BRCA2 gene, you know, put it in the app store. What's it going to cost you to make? Maybe $100 for the toolkit. I don't know. I was thinking about that one. You know, it wouldn't be touching the evil part of the machine, just building the interface to read your data for the stupid people. Anyway, for cash down, My Genome gives you a digital report on your whole genome and an app to interact with your data, plus assistance with interpretation and counseling via a video conference. This service, which is currently taking pre-orders, is available only in the U.S., and doctor's approval is required. But while it's an impressive and potentially life-altering service that significantly undercuts the cost of other commercial genome sequencing products, there is an ongoing debate about how useful or conclusive these troves of individualized genetic data are in terms of improving health for otherwise healthy people. And yes, this was a PSYOP, Angelina Jolie's highly publicized decision to undergo a double mastectomy, and came out after finding that her genes had given her a high risk of developing breast cancer. And what's even more interesting, just as a side note, and I had it up here. Here it is. There's a story I found last night. You know, here's the thing. When she first did that, like someone like Angelina Jolie, someone that like every young 14-year-old boy at the time probably had all kinds of inappropriate thoughts about, married to Brad Pitt, UN ambassador to wherever, she goes and has both of her breasts cut off because she had this gene that put her at a high risk of getting breast cancer. And she had multiple family members who had died of it. I can see the surprise and alarm, but to have a double mastectomy, especially when science is moving at lightning speed, seemed kind of odd to me, considering that she found out that information using genetic data. Well, wait to hear this. And I'm not really sure like what these drugs are or exactly what they do, but this definitely caught my attention last night. Dumb, 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 Angelina Jolie, if that's what she did, because check it out, combination of drugs shrinks breast cancer tumors in just 11 days. This is big. Using a combination of two drugs, scientists have managed to shrink and even eliminate a specific type of breast cancer tumor in just as little as 11 days. And you know, here's the thing. If Jolie was so in bed with all the globalists like she is, then she absolutely would have known about their genetic discoveries and how fast things are moving for switch flipping, turning things on and off, and manipulating our genes. Why would you get a double mastectomy? You know, you got all the money the world could possibly want and get any type of treatment. I mean, look at how many famous people go in and get all the special treatments and live to be in their hundreds and look like they're in their 80s. You know, it just seems to me that that was a little bit of a knee-jerk reaction to something that is evolving science that is increasing by leaps and bounds. Anyway, the results are reported about this reducing the breast cancer tumor in just 11 days at the European Breast Cancer Conference in Amsterdam, which means that they're there to be peer-reviewed, but if they hold up to the scrutiny, the findings suggest that for some women, a new treatment could replace the need. Sorry, I almost started a fire here. The treatment could replace the need for chemotherapy altogether. The combination of drugs targets the HER2 protein. How interesting, it's called the HER2. Which is found in around 1 in 10 breast cancers and is known to make the tumors particularly aggressive and resistant to treatment. The results are so incredible because the researchers weren't even trying to shrink the tumors in the first place. They were simply investigating the benefits of giving women drugs in the short window between a tumor being diagnosed and surgically removed. But by the time the patients were ready to undergo surgery, the tumors had already disappeared in some patients, taking just 11 days to shrink away. We were particularly surprised that these findings in such a short-term trial, says one of the lead researchers, Judith Bliss from the Institute of Cancer Research in London. It became apparent some had a complete response, and it's absolutely intriguing that it is so fast. The experiment was conducted with 257 women who had been diagnosed with HER2-positive breast cancer between 1 and 3 centimeters in size. And out of those participants, 66 of them received the combination of the two drugs, and in less than 2 weeks, 11% of them saw their tumors disappear entirely. Only 17% of them had tumors left less than 5 millimeters in size left, and we hope that this particularly impressive combination trial will serve as a stepping stone to an era of more personalized treatments. Yes, it's all about personalized medicine, people. For the HER2-positive breast cancer, such a rapid response to treatment could soon give doctors the unprecedented ability to identify women responding so well that they would not need chemotherapy. More studies, of course, will need to be done on the long-term benefits of the treatment before researchers start recommending it to patients, particularly seeing as HER2-positive breast cancer has such a high risk of coming back. So, you know, the reason why I shared that story is because that came out yesterday. I mean, this whole genome thing and Angelina Jolie's double mastectomy was probably about a year ago she had that. But what a knee-jerk reaction, and especially as this science is spinning its way to science fiction. It just seemed very odd to me. It seemed as a way to kind of get people to jump on board and get themselves tested to protect themselves. You know, do something right for you and get your breasts cut off because you might have a high risk of cancer. I don't know. I don't really know what that was all about, but it wasn't right. I don't know if she even had that done. Maybe she did. And if she did, that was very dumb on her perspective. Like I said, especially with the mad science treatments that are going on right now and this HER2 cancer. I mean, you know, who knows what the treatment is, because it doesn't say. They're targeting a protein, which means that I'm sure that they're using some sort of RNA switch flipping something. But on the other hand, you know, if you had this BRCA gene, and you know, who even knows, maybe some point in the future, they'll be able to go in and use that CRISPR-Cas9 and just trim those BRCA genes right out of there. I also saw, by the way, you know, there's been this patent dispute over who actually owns the CRISPR technology, and that Jennifer Doudna was one of the original scientists who worked on it, but she and her partner are having some arguments, and it's gone to court over who owns the technology. Well, I just saw the company, I don't remember the name of them, but whatever they spun out, the name of the company that is like the parent of the CRISPR tech, their stock took a big tumble because of the legal entanglement still going on. I don't know. Just thought I'd share that. All right, anyway, back to Jolie. So Angelina Jolie's highly publicized decision, and yes, it was fully intentional, to undergo a double mastectomy came about after finding her genes gave her a high risk of developing breast cancer. And we had read somewhere that there was a huge number of people after that that stepped up and had their genome sequenced just because of Angelina Jolie. And I think that was the point. You know, people are dumb. You see someone on reality TV or a movie and you'll follow them blindly anywhere. At least most of the majority of the dumb, unknowing American public. While awareness has of this gene has led many more women to having preventative genetic testing or surgeries. And there we go. And they're calling it the Angelina Jolie effect. Some claim most genome data offers a far less clear-cut risk analysis, as scientists still don't fully understand the role of genes in many diseases. And no, they don't. And that's why you would never have any of this mad science gone mad medicine as 1.0 or even 2.0, maybe 11.0 once they got it all figured out. But they definitely don't have it all figured out when they start telling you that it can't possibly be, you know, I don't know, X, Y, and Z that's causing the disease. Don't think that they understand everything that they're talking about when we get to a genetic level. They can flip a switch here and it affects 10 switches down the road. And those switches may not show up for a couple generations. It's just, it's not an exact science. We are just in the infantile stages of understanding all this. It says right now, we have tremendous amounts of noise with minimal signals, says Eric Topol, director of the Scripps Translational Science Institute in California. And the best thing would be to run a study to see if it actually helped people. Show us some data that this is really ready for prime time. So bravo, Eric Topol. According to Veritas Genetics, consumers should focus on what the data could tell them and not worry about what it can't, of course, especially as science advances and more discoveries will be made about what the code is telling us. People should be completely unconcerned about what sequencing can't do, says the company's co-founder, geneticist George Church. If I want to buy a car, I don't want to hear that it can't go to the moon or that it can't go into the water. I want to know what it can do, he said. And this same thinking goes for genetics. If I knew that some diagnostic test could indicate the potential risk of developing cancer, I would take it almost without regards to cost. And while the jury is still out on how much of these tests can actually tell us about our risk of developing specific diseases, if they do end up being accurate, are people really ready to hear the news that their genetic results could tell them? Providing clear health insights can be determined, and would you really want to know, though? And in a sense, it is only an advancement on what other kinds of diagnostic tools already disclosed to us. But placing all that data in somebody's lap in one go could be a burden that some aren't prepared for. And I mean, blah, blah, blah. Put it in your dossier. Run IBM Watson's artificially intelligent cognitive computing against it, because he's already back-ending a lot of the cancer research and healthcare at Sloan Kettering Institute. And then let's let Watson tell us what's best for us. Let's let Watson tell us what we should be eating every day through our little Fitbit watch or a Google watch or whoever, Apple watch, that's monitoring your vital signs and reporting them back to your doctor as well. I mean, the future is a very frightening place. They're going to be able to monitor us down to our DNA level and then determine what your future outcomes are going to be, tell you whether or not you're, what you're eating. Oh, that beef isn't good for your genome. Here, have some bug protein. It's much healthier. This is just very scary to me. So now that test is available for under $1,000. And you know, once you're sequenced, though, who's going to guarantee you that that data isn't put into the wrong hands? And do you really want your entire DNA genome out there in the cloud? Do you want the feds being able to know everything there is about you? And we also looked at some of the ethics. Once that information is out there, can health insurance or life insurance companies get their hands on that? And I had done some research way back. We'd run across something that had actually said that there's a loophole in the law. Health insurance is not allowed to discriminate against you if they find that you have, like, let's say, a BRCA gene. But life insurance is. And there is not a law that prevents life insurance from being able to determine that you might not be worth insuring. Anyway, now that that test is available for under $1,000, which makes it viable for many, consumers may have to face some of their demons if they really want to find out about what their genetics could have in store for them. And we ask ourselves, what would people be willing to pay for this? And remember, that's the sweet spot, they call it. Sub-$1,000 PC caused it to go crazy. And so guess what? They released the genome, fully sequenced at $9.99. And he says, and this is the chief executive of Veritas, when is the price no longer the main issue? Well, we arrived at $999. That is our magic number. And I'm telling you, it is the sub-$1,000 that makes everybody go crazy. That's just a... that's a PSYOP thingy that they use. So there you have it. Genome sequence for under $1,000. They said it was coming. We knew it was coming, and now it is here. All right, well, I'm having difficulty pulling things up, so we're just going to have to go with what is up here and what I can access. Google. Google's at it again. Google put 14 robot arms in a room, and they worked out how to pick up things from scratch. After 800,000 failed grasp attempts, the group of arms learned from its collective mistakes. Google has created a study group of several robotic arms that can teach themselves how to grasp different objects through a long collective trial and error process. Grasping is no easy task. Humans and primates are able to tweak their movements depending on what they see, a process called hand-eye coordination, so they do not have to devise a particular strategy every time they want to pick up a new object. Robotic arms, in contrast, need to be programmed specifically for each object they need to grab and struggle to operate in potentially confounding environments, which is why automated production lines are highly standardized. Yeah, we had read about some of that before, the industrial robotics and trying to put some sort of artificial intelligence behind them so that they can react to obstacles, let's say, like some unfortunate clown getting in the way that ends up getting crushed by the robotic arm, because the robotic arm isn't expecting anything to get in the way. It's just doing its job. Anyway, a study led by Google's research scientist, Sergey Levine, I guess there's a few Sergeys at Google, reports an experiment in which 14 robotic arms have jointly learned the best pickup strategies after 2 months of training and 800,000 grasp attempts. During the study, the robots were positioned in front of trays, casually strewn. That's a good word. Casually strewn with several objects, which varied in shape, weight, dimension, and hardness without any previous instruction on how to get a grip on each of them. Each robotic arm had a similar design, but not identical, to increase the diversity of the data set. The arms just continuously pounced forward and randomly tried to grab the items, sometimes succeeding by a dint of sheer luck. And each robot's successes and failures were captured by cameras and then fed to a convolutional neural network, which was in charge of tweaking the robotics platoon's behavior. Over time, notice they call it a robotic platoon. Some nice military terms there. Over time, thousands of grab bid data loops through the convolutional neural network, CNN for short, and the system grew apter at predicting what kind of movements were more likely to result in a successful grip. At the end of the experiment, the self-taught robots had become much better at picking up stuff, and their failure rate had fallen down to only 17.5%. Our experimental evaluation demonstrates that our method achieves effective real-time control, can successfully grasp novel objects, and corrects mistakes by continuously servoing, and that is robotic hand-eye coordination. And they also underlined how only human contribution through the whole experiment was replacing the objects in the tray. Google's project builds on the increasingly popular concept that robots can teach other robots. We've talked about this. This is an evolutionary robotics where they were showing mother robots building baby robots using her best traits and passing them on to the young, and then the young able to pass those traits on to their young that they constructed. Guys, evolution and learning and robots should be highly alarming to every single one of you. They're giving these things sentience. They're teaching them to learn. And wait until you hear the story I ran across right before I finally decided I had had enough last night, because this just took the cake and gave me nightmares last night. But let's finish the story and we'll continue on there. So anyway, Google's project builds on the increasingly popular concept that robots can teach each other and teach other robots how to perform specific tasks, or more accurately, how one artificial intelligence can help another AI improve without a human ever intervening. A Brown University project called RoboBrain, for instance, aims to store all of the machine-learned behaviors into a knowledge repository that other robots can tap into. Wow, what a great segue. The project has been nicknamed, quote, the world's first knowledge engine for robots. And even more recently, DeepMind, and that is Google's DeepMind's AlphaGo AI, we talked about this yesterday and last week. The Google's DeepMind AI system has beat yet again the world champion for the world's most complex game called Go. Way, way, way thousands of times more complex than chess. And the Go champion was quite floored at the fact that the computer has learned and has been able to outmaneuver him. All right, now to this highly disturbing story from MIT Technology Review, titled, innocuously enough, Wikipedia for Robots. And I'm sure that at that title, most people won't even read it. Subtitle is a little more telling. People have learned to pool their knowledge. We now need to help machines do the same. Don't help the machines. What are these people thinking? They're doing this in the name of science and research without any thoughts for what the implications of this is. We are giving these things sentience. And once they start thinking and learning and evolving without human intervention, we are beyond screwed. Humans have gained a lot of value by organizing all of their knowledge and making it widely accessible in textbooks and libraries, Wikipedia and YouTube, just to name a few examples. These pools of knowledge aren't valuable just for grand scientific ventures, but also for the trivial stuff of everyday human lives. You can easily find thousands of YouTube videos that will teach you how to cook an omelet. We now live in a world, you know, really the fact that YouTube is owned by Google, it almost makes me think that buying, because originally YouTube wasn't Google's, they had Google Video or something, and then they bought YouTube. But it almost makes me think that by buying YouTube way back when, 2008, I believe it was, actually was part of the whole plan. Because, you know, they've been using now YouTube to teach these AI systems about objects, right? They sent them out and they had them scanning all these videos and learning just like a child would to identify, recognize, and name objects. And I'm sure they're using it for all kinds of other things. They're probably doing sociological studies and understanding how people react to things and facial expressions. You have bazillions of videos from people all over the world, all titled and keyworded perfectly, not really perfectly, but good enough, to then set AI all over that data set to learn as much as it possibly could. It is the electronic library, the internet in general, the electronic library of Alexandria right now, all for the taking and for the learning. All right, back to the story. We now live in a world where robots are helping humans in their daily lives. And yeah, we saw all kinds of them. Good old Nadine. Companion robot. And just like humans, robots need to learn new skills in order to do their job successfully. And we shouldn't expect a robot to learn on its own from scratch any more than we'd expect a human to do so. Imagine a child growing up with no access to textbooks, libraries, or the internet. Well, I think children could do just fine without the internet, since we all managed to get along just fine without it for years. But I would say textbooks would probably be a good thing. I mean, but you even have societies that it did oral tradition for many years and cave drawings. So, you know, bullshit on that, I guess. However, the organized collections, and that's the key, the organization, the organized collections of knowledge that work for humans aren't so great for robots. A robot wouldn't get much useful information if it queried a search engine for how to, quote, bring sweet tea from the kitchen. Robots require something different: access to finer details for planning, control, and natural language understanding. When asked to bring sweet tea, the robot would need access to the knowledge for interpreting the language symbols tea in terms of the physical entities, which would be a particular container for having sweet tea, the spatial knowledge that the sweet tea can either be on a table or in a fridge, and the knowledge for inferring how to grasp and manipulate the object. It is possible to manually script a demo for one particular situation, but handling this across different tasks and in different environments is still an open problem. In 2014, and this is the dude writing this story, Ashutosh Saxena. In 2014, and they just mentioned this in this other story beforehand, I, the author of the story, started a project called RoboBrain at Cornell University. Wow, they're coming up a lot lately. Ding, ding. Along with a PhD student, Ashton Jane, and Ozan Center. And we now have collaborators at Stanford and Brown Universities. And what we were working on is a way of sharing information that allows robots to gather whatever knowledge they need for a task. And see, there's another story called Robots That Teach Each Other. And if one robot learns, then guess what? The knowledge is propagated to all other robots. Guys, the Borg and Hive mind. How frightening is that? One robot learns, and it passes the information and the knowledge on to all other robots. It is distributed learning. RoboBrain achieves this by gathering the knowledge from a variety of sources, and the system stores multiple kinds of information, including symbols, natural language, visual or shape features, haptic properties, and motions. This approach represents a huge shift in thinking. Historically, research groups working with robots have trained the robots in isolation. And yes, we often share ideas through publications and software that can be used by another research group. But what the one robot might learn hasn't been accessible to another researcher's robot. And to add to that problem, research groups have been working on different problems. One might have focused on computer vision of identifying a cup, while the other has been working on the language of the problem, what is a cup, where a third tackled how to grasp a cup. That's the kind of approach that we need to get past. A cup is one object, not three, and a robot, just like a person, needs to be able to have all this knowledge in one place. Hive mind learning, people. What a horrifying concept. I know that they've been working on swarm technologies for quite a while. MIT and Harvard have been working on things with drones, mini drones, those mini aerial vehicles. And here, we're going to hit this. This is that other story. Robots that could teach each other. What if robots could figure out more things on their own and share that knowledge amongst themselves? Many of the jobs that humans would like robots to perform, such as packing items in a warehouse, assisting bedridden patients, of course, or aiding soldiers on the front lines, aren't yet possible because robots still don't recognize and easily handle common objects. People generally have no trouble folding a sock or picking up a water glass because they've gone through, quote, a big data collection process called childhood. But for robots to do the same types of routine tasks, they also need access to reams of data on how to grasp and manipulate the objects. Where does that data come from? Well, typically it has come from painstaking programming. But ideally, the robots could get some information from one another. And that is the theory behind Telex's Million Object Challenge. The goal is for research robots around the world to learn how to spot and handle simple items from bowls to bananas and then upload their data to the cloud and allow other robots to analyze and use this information. Telex's lab in Providence, Rhode Island has the air of a playful preschool. On the day that I visited, the Baxter robot, which we've seen Baxter. Baxter actually is relatively inexpensive. I think I remember him being like under $10,000 or something. And he was like within the realm of small to medium businesses being able to have their own Baxter now that you can program. On the day that I visited, a Baxter robot, an industrial machine produced by Rethink Robotics, stands among oversized blocks scanning a small hairbrush. It moves it to the right arm, noisily back and forth, taking multiple pictures with its camera and measuring the depth with an infrared sensor. Then, with its two-prong gripper, it tries different grasps that might allow it to lift the brush. And once it is the object in the air, it shakes it to make sure the grip is secure. If so, the robot has learned to pick up one more object. The robot can work around the clock, frequently with a different object in each of its grippers. And Telex and her graduate student, John Oberlin, have gathered and are now sharing data on roughly 200 items, starting with such things as a child's shoe, a plastic boat, a rubber duck, a garlic press and other cookware, a sippy cup that originally belonged to her three-year-old son, among others. Other scientists can contribute their robots' own data, and Telex hopes that together they will build a library of information on how robots should handle a million different items. Eventually, yeah, how long is it going to be before they put some how to choke a throat? And this is just so frightening. Eventually, robots confronting a crowded shelf will be able to, quote, identify the pen in front of them and pick it up. Objects like this or projects like this are possible because many research robots use the same standard framework for programming known as ROS. And once one machine learns a given task, it can pass that data on to others. And those machines can then upload the feedback that will then in turn refine the instructions given to subsequent machines. Telek says that the data about how to recognize and grasp any given object can be compressed to just 5 to 10 megabytes, about the size of a song in your music library. Telek was an early adopter in a project called RoboBrain, which demonstrated how one robot can learn from another's experience. And her collaborator, Ashutosh Saxena, and that's the guy that we just read the last story from, then from Cornell, taught his PR2 robot to lift small cups and position them on the table. And then at Brown University, Telek downloaded that information from the cloud and used it to train her Baxter robot, which is physically different, to perform the same task in a fully different environment. Such progress might seem incremental now, but in the next 5 to 10 years, we can expect to see, quote, an explosion in the ability of robots, unquote, says Saxena. Now a startup, a CEO of a startup called Brain of Things. Brain of Things. Wonder if the Internet of Things will be able to tap into the Brain of Things. This is really scary. As researchers contribute to and refine cloud-based knowledge, she says, robots should have access to all of the information they need right at their fingertips. All right. I had one more. Actually, I had a couple more, but we'll have to see. I can't even roll over a tab, so let's see what I got going here. You know what? We got 10 minutes here, so I got two last stories we're going to hit. One is about this new... Let's see if we can get this to come up. This new brain project. Well, what? We're sorry, we cannot find this page. Hold the phone. Hold the phone. Actually, I think I might have posted this one, maybe, on my own page somewhere. Hold on, here it is. The U.S. government launches a $100 million Apollo project of the brain. Intelligence project aims to reverse engineer the brain to find algorithms that allow computers to think more like humans. Guys, couple this with making a large repository for learning knowledge to give to computers, robots, and AI. And then the whole brain project in and of itself, learning how the brain works. This is beyond frightening. They're making this happen. Our robot overlords are being designed right now. 3 decades ago, the U.S. government launched the Human Genome Project. Yes, talked about the genome. Sub-$1,000 now, $9.99 just for you. A 13-year endeavor to sequence and map all the genes of all the human species. And now they've done bugs and plants and everything else as well. Although initially met with skepticism and even opposition, the project has transformed the field of genetics and is considered today to be one of the most successful scientific enterprises in history. Yes, and now you have organizations like DARPA who've databased all this genomic information. They're finding ways to slice and dice and push a button to create life on demand. But don't worry about that. That's just happening with your tax dollars. Now, IARPA, yes, the Intelligence Advanced Research Project Activity. I don't know, I would think it's agency, but whatever, it's IARPA, a research organization for the intelligence community modeled after the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency, or DARPA, has dedicated $100 million to a similarly ambitious project. The Machine Intelligence from Cortical Networks Program, or MICRONs, now aims to reverse engineer 1 cubic millimeter of the brain, study the way it makes computations, and then use those findings to better inform algorithms in machine learning and artificial intelligence. So they are, and I'm sure that they've already done it, they can grow little mini brains and dishes and little brain balls, but they're manufacturing and bodies on a chip. We talked about that yesterday as well. So they're able to manufacture all this stuff and now study 1 cubic centimeter of brain, watch exactly how it all works, and then feed that information into the machine to mimic. IARPA has recruited 3 teams led by David Cox, a biologist and a computer scientist at Harvard University, Tai Sing Lee, a computer scientist at Carnegie Mellon University, and Andreas Tolisis, a neuroscientist at Baylor College of Medicine, and each team has proposed its own 5-year approach to the problem. It is a substantial investment because we think it is a critical challenge, and it'll have a transformative impact, yes, disruptive transformative impact for the intelligence community as well as world more broadly, says Jacob Volkelstein at IARPA, who manages the Microns program. Microns, yes, Microns, as part of Obama's Brain Initiative, is an attempt to push forward the status quo in brain-inspired computing. And a great deal of technology today already relies on a class of algorithms called artificial neural networks, which, as their name would suggest, are inspired by the architecture, or at least what we know about the architecture of the brain. And thanks to significant increases in our computing power and the availability of vast amounts of data on the internet, Facebook can identify faces, Siri can recognize voices, cars can self-navigate, and computers can beat humans at games like chess and now Go. These algorithms, however, are still primitive, relying on highly simplified processes of analyzing information for patterns. Based on models dating back to the 1980s, neural networks tend to perform poorly in cluttered environments where the object the computer is trying to identify is hidden among a large number of objects, many of which are overlapping or ambiguous. These algorithms do not generalize well either, and seeing one or two examples of a dog, for instance, does not teach the computer how to identify all dogs. Well, don't worry about it, because it seems they're already working on identification and grasping. Humans, on the other hand, seem to overcome these challenges effortlessly. We can make out a friend in a crowd, focus on a familiar voice in a noisy setting, and deduce patterns in sounds or images based on just a handful of examples. We are constantly learning to generalize without the need for any instruction. And so the Microns researchers have turned to the human brain to find out what these models are missing. This is the smoking gun, says Cox. While neural networks retain elements of the architecture found in the brain, the computations they use are not copied directly from any algorithm that neurons use to process information. In other words, the ways in which current algorithms represent, transform, and learn from data are engineering solutions determined largely by trial and error, just like in the last story. They work, but scientists really don't know why, certainly not well enough to define a way to design a neural network, and whether this neural processing is similar to or different from corresponding operations in the brain remains unknown. So if we go one level deeper and take information from the brain at a computational level and not just the architectural level, and remember DARPA just released their new little brain implant neuron reading stent, so I'm sure that'll help out a lot. So we go one level deeper and take information from the brain at a computational level, not just an architectural level, we can enhance those algorithms and get them closer to brain-like performance. And, you know, the story goes on and on. And maybe we will continue with this on Monday because I want to hit one more thing for the end of the show. We got about 2 minutes left. Don't you crunch on me, computer. This is out of CNN Money yesterday, actually on the 8th. Good old Kurzweil rears his ugly head. Computers will overtake us when they learn to love, says futurist Ray Kurzweil. We were talking about Nadine, the companion robot. Well, let's give Nadine some loving. Ray Kurzweil, the celebrated American inventor who keeps predicting the future with scary accuracy and who now is the Google engineer for the DeepMind AI project, says computers will match and possibly beat human intelligence by 2029. But here's the trick. By then, computers will possess emotions and personalities. Remember, we talked about uploading and downloading Nana from the cloud into her new avatar. I really think that they are going to be able to crack that as they work more and more on the brain and these neural net projects. This is very frightening. When I talk about computers reaching human levels of intelligence, I am not talking about logical intelligence, says Ray Kurzweil at an event in New York City last week. It is being funny and expressing a loving sentiment. That is the cutting edge of human intelligence. The futurist spoke about AI and the future of technology with astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson. When Tyson pushed back and asked if computers will one day write a Nobel Prize-winning novel and supplant even that aspect of what it is to be human, Kurzweil said he puts it a bit differently. We are going to combine with that intelligence, he says. Well, how cell-sized nanobots in our brain will connect us to the global internet and let us download our skills matrix style. We will also edit genes like computer code to cure diseases, says Kurzweil. Nanobots will be available to everyone, he says, and these technologies are ultimately democratized because they keep getting less and less expensive. All right, well, let's get Kurzweil's nanobots in our blood and connect us to the internet 24/7 so we can be part of the hive mind. All right, guys, well, make sure you have an awesome weekend because it is Friday. Stick around. We have Lonnie Clark live up next. Libby Aleve's 5-year anniversary Fukushima special. Primer time tonight. Truth on the Tracks with Brandon. Cutting Through the Matrix. Belmont and Levon. Take care, everyone. Catch up with you Monday.